Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four clauses on its oral submission document. In the order in which they will be heard, they are Southwestern Electric Power Company versus Burlington Northern Railroad Company from Bowie County, Associated Indemnity Corporation and Fireman's Fund Insurance Company versus Cat Contracting Incorporated and others from Cameron County, State Farm Fire and Casualty Company versus James and Cynthia Simmons from Montgomery County, and H.E. Butt Grocery Company versus Vinnie Velotto from Bexar County. In each of these arguments, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude these arguments before our lunch break. The arguments are being taped by the clerk's office, and you may purchase a copy of an oral tape by making application with our clerk. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Southwestern Electric versus Burlington Northern.
May it please the court, Mr. Harry Reidner will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case presents contractual overcharges and 25-year multi-billion-dollar railroad coal hauling contracts. The two contracts involved are clearly, by their explicit terms, cost-plus contracts with escalation to be up or down based on the increase in the railroad's cost. With the abolition of ICC regulation under the Staggers Act of 1980, the only place for the consumers of Texas, SWEPCO, to turn for enforcement of these contracts is to the state courts of Texas.
How about the rate adjustments that are made? Amicus claims that there's been already an adjustment made by SWEPCO, and then SWEPCO's already gotten their what they're due from the ratepayers.
Your Honor, points to a very important point that I want to return to, and that is that two issues were tried. There are two contractual provisions that were tried to the trial court. One, the gross inequity provision, which I think Your Honor is referring to. Two, the breach of the contract, the overcharges under the contract on an unjust enrichment theory. The trial court below made a material error, and I respectfully submit made a farce of the trial of the gross inequity provision by allowing evidence of SWEPCO's financial health into the picture and allowing the railroads to argue to the jury that there could be no gross inequity, no matter how great the overcharge, if SWEPCO was in sound financial condition. Of course, that is absurd, since those fuel charges, those rate charges imposed by the railroads were properly flowed through, and the cost of them was borne by the consumers of the state of Texas, and I think you have a Mickey brief to that effect. But there was no relief there. And let me come to what I think the crux of this case is. No question that the parties explicitly state this is the intent of these contracts is cost plus. Base rates were established under both contracts. Then they attempted to put in formulas so that they would escalate up or down based on the railroad's cost. What happened is, particularly after deregulation, prior to deregulation, the railroads were always trying to get cost increases, and evidence was kept out that showed that the railroads interpreted them to mean that they were entitled to get any increase in their cost under this contract. Now, for example, and this I believe is in tab 6 of the books you have here, there's been an enormous divergence between cost and the rate charges. This isn't even an issue. The railroads refused to even produce their cost studies, let their experts be stricken and not even testify on it. Uncontroverted, that there's this enormously widening gap and that the basic purpose of these contracts has been breached and frustrated. The railroad's position is twofold. First, they argue that there is a gross inequity provision in the contract that provides that under unusual economic circumstances, if there's a gross inequity because the costs are not fairly covered, then the contract can be changed by mutual agreement. They argue first that that's an exclusive remedy. It doesn't say it's an exclusive remedy. It's contrary to all principles of interpretation to make that an exclusive remedy without further indication that was the intent of the parties. But secondly, and even more remarkably, they say not only is it an exclusive remedy, but the courts have no power to enforce it. They move for summary judgment that it was merely an agreement to try to agree and unenforceable by the courts, and I put that page from their summary judgment in briefs. But then they, and if you read the briefs carefully, they don't concede it to this court. They tell you it's exclusive. Basically, the railroad's position is, sure, these are cost-plus contracts, sure, they're out of whack, but all that SWEPCO can do is depend on the kindness of the railroad to renegotiate the contract if it chooses to do so, because it has no legal remedy.
So your position is, if there were gross equity, inequity, not fairly covered, then damages could be awarded rather than simply some other dissolution of the contract or some other remedy.
Your Honor, our position is that if we had obtained a finding under the gross inequity clause, we could have obtained a new base rate and perhaps a new formula, because this formula this formula has failed in its purpose to breach the contract. We did not obtain jury findings on that. I respectfully submit it was because of the material error of allowing the jury to believe that we had to prove that SWEPCO was suffering economically, and because the jury was deprived of knowing that BM had administered this contract, this clause, in precisely the way that we say it should be administered. That evidence was kept from the jury. Our secondary ground, Your Honor, was to obtain a finding, and this is at tabs 1 and 2 of the little booklet you have, issues 7 and 9, to obtain a finding that there had been a breach of the contract, that there was a disparity between the amount that was actually paid under the contract and what should have been paid under the contract. And further, that the retention of that differential between what was paid and should have been paid would unjustly enrich the railroads.
By should have been paid, you don't mean equitably, you mean under the contract.
Under the contract.
And should have is just a shorthand expression for what was due under the contract.
Precisely, Your Honor. I believe it's at tab 3 of the little book. Yeah, we pleaded under the contract, no question, that issues 7 and 9 submitted to the jury the question, what should have been paid under the contract. That was the only evidence they heard from our cost expert saying under proper cost accounting. Let me pause here and to say one of the many straw men that the railroad puts up is that there's some problem about this. There is a uniform system of railroad accounting mandated by law. Railroads annually collect these costs, by law required to report them to the Department of Transportation. There's no problem in ascertaining what these costs are and regulating and effectuating the purpose of the contract for it to be a cost-plus contract.
Was the contract to be based on a particular railroad's cost or the average industry cost?
Your Honor, an excellent question, and I think if you look at the formula intent clause, very clear, not only the formula applies to two different market baskets of cost, one to Western Railroads, the second the 1984 contract to an ICC formulation, but the contract refers specifically to not only the B&N's cost, but to SWEPCO's cost. SWEPCO's cost of hauling, and they can trace it to the train. So, and I think it's very clear that under the contract, the costs that are to go up and down are SWEPCO's hauling hauling costs.
Do you have, is there any case law that construes clauses like this where the parties agree to mutually agree? Is there any case law that says what happens if they can't agree or vote?
Your Honor, there is. Let me say that I'm not prepared on this issue because we lost it to the jury in the court below, and I did not try this case, and I did not familiarize myself with the arguments pro and con. The railroads argued this was unenforceable. We argued it was enforceable. We could certainly file a short supplement with the court with the authority on that issue.
Mr. Reisner, the argument here seems to be that Burlington Northern is just making too much money off this deal. Is there a price in this contract, or is it always a jury question when the parties disagree that we're paying? I mean, what I see here is simply an argument by SWEPCO that we're just being charged too much. You would go to the contract, and the contract has two provisions in it, and we're claiming it's one of those applies. Now let's go to a jury. But all I see here is just the argument they're just charging too much.
Well, let me say first, Your Honor, we are being charged. We are being obscenely overcharged.
Is that the threshold? I guess that's my point.
Okay.
How do you keep this not being a jury question every single time?
Well, I don't know. I think if the court reinstates the trial court judgment, this will be worked out. I don't believe they'll have a problem with it. But let me say, this is not a mere complaint about we're being charged too much. It is a complaint that they have breached the contract. If you look at the formula and intent provision under both contracts, it states as clear as you can state that any changes in the cost of transporting this coal to SWEPCO up or down is to be taken into account. A base rate was established, and what happened here is that they attempted to use proxies. These formulas that simply failed, that frustrated contractual intent, the explicit contractual intent. Now, we don't have an alternative rate formula, but this is no different, Your Honor, than a contract that calls for market value or calls for a just and reasonable rate. Here, what it calls for is the base rate, which is a specific, agreed-on number, escalated by their cost. And it doesn't say, if all this contract said was, here's the base rate, and we're going to escalate your rates under this formula, we wouldn't be here. It doesn't say that.
What do we do with the formula? There is a formula, and the parties say, it's supposed to cover our costs. If we can't agree, then the contract has to protect. What do we do?
I think, Your Honor, that you can, and the evidence on this was very clear. And these are matters of routine determining railroad cost. The contract, the formula was a proxy to try to deal with escalation over time.
It's just a pure cost plus, and you say that it's that easy to determine cost over time. Why didn't they just say this is a cost plus contract and any cost above or below the 1971 base cost will be taken into account and those will be all right?
I think they did. That's what they said.
Why did they?
They say this is the intent of the parties. They put in a formula, and frankly, Your Honor, before deregulation in 1980 and before competitive pressures completely changed the nature of the railroad market, those formulas were probably reasonable proxies under regulation. Railroad rates very rarely went down. But the guts of the contract, and they tell you what their intent is, it was base rate escalation as to cost. And the courts clearly can administer and enforce the agreement of the parties, and that's what contract interpretation is about, seeing that the intent of the parties is honored.
Mr. Reisner, would you briefly address the legal underpinnings of your unjust enrichment argument? I think that despite your briefing, the law is far from clear on this particular issue.
Surely, Your Honor, I certainly will attempt to do it. It seems to me that the confusion that arises here is that there are many cases that speak broadly that when you have an express contract, you can't have quasi-contractual or equitable remedies. I think what they're referring to are remedies in the nature of quantum merit. For example, where you have an express contract, but you would in effect try to vary, contradict it by remedies such as quantum merit. I think, Your Honor, that, and it is the genius of the common law that we are taught from the first year in law school not to take sweeping statements too broadly, but to look at the specific application of the case. And I think, and we have cited many such cases, where there are express contracts, but an equitable remedy such as unjust enrichment or money had and received is used as a remedy to enforce the contract. For example, there's the Vegeta case where Mr. Hatchell argued before this court where there was a violation of an express oil and gas lease which provided for half royalty and paid 16th, had a division order. The court looked to the doctrine of unjust enrichment to say, we won't be barred by the division order. We will nevertheless apply unjust enrichment. Money had and received, you have to give it back. The Bowers case is another. It was the classic way to deal with railroad reparation cases, with freight overcharges before the creation of the ICC and the people being remitted to administrative remedies. I think it will come again, but you take here, classic situation, we were paying under duress. We had to keep the lights burning in the cities. We had to take this coal, and even though we knew we were being overcharged, even though we disagreed with the invoices, we had to pay. So
because,
I think...
Because you freely join into a contract here, why would the provisions that you just discussed in the first part of your argument not be provisions that you pursue to seek remedy instead of seeking unjust enrichment?
Well, we sought it as a contractual remedy. You know, first we tried to get gross inequity and we failed, and I've told you how I thought the jury was misled. Secondly, we asked for this remedy. We said, find that the contract has been breached.
I know you asked for it, but I don't understand legally why you would be entitled to it in addition to the gross inequity.
Well, I would say two reasons. One, the gross inequity provision is not exclusive. It doesn't say it's exclusive. In fact, in the 84 contract, there is an express provision that says all other rights and remedies are reserved. They are the ones who have got to make the extremely unattractive argument that it was the intent of the parties that they entered into a contract, explicitly stated the intent was to make it cost plus, but provided no legal remedy. Because they'll tell you that the gross inequity provision, merely agreement to agree, not enforceable. But there's nothing in there that says this is the exclusive remedy. And I submit to you that the normal inference is when there's not an agreement on an exclusive remedy, and we can show that they breached the contract in the sense that they increased the charges more than their cost had increased above the base rate, then we are entitled to a remedy.
So to make it clear, very clear, on your unjust enrichment claim, you're not seeking equity, you're seeking to enforce the contract.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, it is equitable in a historical sense, but it is, we seek to enforce the contract, we want our just part of the differential of the overcharge.
And the language that you rely on to say the contractual base for your argument is in the gross inequity provision.
No, Your Honor. It is in the formula intent provision, as I would say it. The first contract has the heading formula intent, and then it states what the intent of the parties was with regard to the cost. The second contract, I think, is headed gross inequity, and then
but both provisions have the language.
Both the provisions have this language on cost. Both state this is our purpose: base rate, cost escalations. Up or down.
Mr. Reason, did I understand you say that the renegotiated contract has a clause that specifically states that you reserve other remedies at law or in equity?
Yes,
but
yes.
The first one doesn't.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that a material difference?
I think not, Your Honor.
Then why would you put it in there the second time?
Believe me, I didn't have anything to do with that.
Well, but it's your people.
I would say it was the fell of Paddy Man's burden if I were to make a literary illusion. Your Honor, I would say that, as I would understand Texas law, the presumption is the other way. If you don't say it's exclusive, then it's not exclusive. Here, somebody in broad reading said, you know, further, we have all these other things. First one, it's not there, but I believe the law would presume it to be there. I think it's your duty. If you want somebody limited to a single remedy, I think you have to say so.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Hatcher will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I have handed out to the court a bench memorandum that I think will be helpful to the court. What he has is the unjust enrichment submission, the reproduction of question 7. Question 7 and 9 are the questions upon which this judgment must stand or fall. The second part of my handout is a reproduction of the clause that SWEPCO contends was violated in this case, the gross inequity clause. If the court could refer to those, I think that the argument will be much more understandable. It's very important to understand the nature of this contract in order to understand the arguments. The two contracts are largely identical insofar as the provisions that we are talking about. One of the contracts calls the provision a formula intent in the heading, and the second contract calls the clause a gross inequity clause, and they are virtually identical clauses. The way the contracts work is this. There is an initial transportation rate specifically set in the contract for hauls of coal under the contracts. That rate is adjusted in one case, one contract is adjusted annually, and in the other contract it's adjusted quarterly, based upon a formula published by government agencies. And the formulas, candidly, are different in both contracts. The formula in the latter contract actually has a component in it that takes into account Burlington Northern's own specific costs insofar as they are part of railroad costs. And what the parties were doing, I disagree fundamentally with the opposing counsel's characterization of this case as a cost-plus contract. In the railroad industry, the computation of costs is a raging battle. You could have the simplest of contracts that in which you had only one cost component in the railroad industry, and you could get 10 experts who would come up with different ways of evaluating those costs.
Can we tell that by looking at the record in this case?
Indeed. Because there were two experts that testified on their side and two experts on our side, and they are $177 million apart on cost alone. So what the parties did in this case was to adopt a surrogate for any increases or decreases in the railroad's cost of transporting this coal. And what they did was to adopt the formula intent clause, the gross inequity clause that is later called. And it says it is the intent of Burlington Northern, KCS, LA, and SWEPCO that the formulas will compensate the railroads for any changes in the cost of transporting SWEPCO's coal. The formulas will do that. The formulas take into account changes in cost, and they adjust the rates. There is a third mechanism for adjusting rates in these two clauses, and that is where a, quote, gross inequity is suffered by one of the parties as a result of unusual economic conditions.
You say this is a mechanism for adjusting the rates?
It is a mechanism for deriving a new rate, I think is the more accurate way. And Justice Owen has asked a very telling question, is in view of the fact that the rate adjusted under the gross inequity formula is one that has to be mutually agreed upon by the parties. How does it get into court? Fortunately, we don't have to deal with that issue. It's a somewhat complex issue, Your Honor. I think the Moorburger case from this court is the leading authority on agreements to agree. And while I have views as to how the matter could be gotten in court, the gross inequity submission in this case, by which SWEPCO attempted to claim overcharges through the occurrence of a gross inequity, was answered negatively by the jury, and that issue went out of the case. So bear with me in mind now what we have gone through. You have a contract that has an initial rate, a rate that is adjusted for changes in costs for, based on a formula, and you have a rate that is determined by mutual agreement if a gross inequity occurs. Those are the only three rates that can be charged in this contract. The initial rate is no longer applicable because the contracts have proceeded through the years and have bypassed that rate. The adjusted rate worked perfectly, and SWEPCO has admitted that every charge that we have made in this case was computed precisely and accurately in accordance with the formulas. Or if they were not computed accurately, we adjusted the rates in accordance with the formulas. So those are the two contract rates, and the gross inequity rate has dropped out of the case by virtue of the jury finding.
Let me ask you real quickly, do you agree that that is a fact question that should have been submitted to the jury?
I was afraid Your Honor would ask me that question because I'd probably have about 10 minutes answer to the question. I'm not sure that I agree in this case that it should have been. I agree that it can be.
But you're not arguing up here that it was a question of law?
No, because the gross inequity question has been answered in our favor, who I failed to find, and we don't reach the issue. It's not a basis for the judgment.
Assuming that was properly a fact question for the jury and they did give a negative answer or did fail to find, why wasn't it prejudicial? SWEPCO to introduce the financial condition on the gross inequity question?
Because, as the Interstate Commerce itself has said, the understanding of the name gross inequity requires one to look at the impact of economic conditions upon the party claiming the gross inequity.
Well, shouldn't we look at the impact on the ratepayers here since this was passed?
No, you should not look at the impact on the ratepayers, Your Honor, because insofar as ratepayers are concerned, they're fully protected by the Public Utility Commission. This contract is subject to the Public Utility Commission scrutiny insofar as the rates are concerned, and the public is particularly well protected as a result of any fuel adjustment problems, because there are specific provisions of the Public Regulatory Act which allows the PUC to adjust the electric rates upwards or downwards if there is an imbalance in fuel costs.
But that's different, isn't it, from adjusting these transportation charges between SWEPCO and Burlington Northern? The PUC or the PURA can't directly act on those, can
you? That is exactly correct, but I don't think that the public is particularly concerned about whether or not SWEPCO's stockholders get dividends.
No, but these costs are directly passed through, are they not?
Well, what I was saying was there are provisions where they can be passed through.
Yes. They currently are being passed through.
Well, I'm not sure that I can answer that question on the basis of this record, Your Honor, but I think that it is not an illogical presumption to say that they are. But again, the Public Utility Commission can act even on its own initiative if these are not in the public interest. As a matter of fact, SWEPCO bragged to the PUC when these contracts were done about what wonderful contracts they were. And they were particularly proud of the fact that the Welsh contract, the second contract, contained in the escalation formula provisions whereby the costs could go down as adjusted under the formula because of Burlington Northern's actual productivity savings.
Do you disagree with the chart that was on the diesel, that the costs have in fact gone down considerably?
The costs have gone down, yes. They have gone down as a result of what is known in the industry as productivity savings. I guess the best way I could put that, Your Honor, is that Burlington has made money, in this case, the old-fashioned way. They earned it.
Is that because of deregulation?
It's probably a combination of things, Your Honor. Deregulation only allowed Burlington the flexibility to meet pricing demands without having to go through such a tremendous regulatory process. It's probably the demand for coal as a clean, efficient, and fairly economical fossil fuel to run generation plants that has fueled the probably the demand for coal and therefore the profitability of these contracts. And quite frankly, that can change on a moment's notice.
Getting back to growth and equity, though, under your definition, a financially healthy company would never be able to rely on this provision of the contract because they're in good financial condition. Is that your
No, I don't think that's true, but I do think that, you know, the contract uses the word suffers. And I think that if you're going to apply all of the words, suffering, and as a result of unusual economic conditions, that a jury ought to be able to see whether or not the company that is claiming a gross inequity is suffering, but particularly if its financial condition has been affected by unusual economic conditions. Looking at the financial status of a company to determine whether or not it has been impacted by something which is unusual economically, which seems to me to be a very, very relevant inquiry. And
well, there might be something unusual out of the economy that impacts severely a healthy company. The company is still healthy, but that's not inconsistent.
I don't think it's inconsistent, but I do think that it is a relevant inquiry, and SWEPCO must have thought it was, because they fill this record with volumes of evidence about Burlington Northern's productivity. Probably an entire volume of the statement of facts has to do with all of the money we've made, how we're prospering under these contracts, and that was to demonstrate to the jury that what has happened is, quote, unusual, an unusual economic condition that we have profited so greatly in this country.
But didn't you say earlier that the productivity is a part and parcel of the cost determination? So
yes.
Wasn't that evidence material to determining the cost if they were disputing what they were?
Yeah, I think it's material.
Let me ask you another question. If I understand your answer to Justice Owen's question, your evidence to put in, that you put in on the financial condition of SWEPCO was of a general nature to show their entire financial circumstances based on a theory that, they had to show a gross inequity to their entire financial condition?
Now, as a result of unusual economic conditions.
Can you agree that when you read the rest of that clause that it's not a general gross inequity to the entire financial condition, but which results in the formula failing to cover certain cost changes?
Oh, certainly I would agree with that.
So then would any evidence of the gross inequity be limited to this particular contract between the parties and whether the cost had changed to an extent that under the contracts SWEPCO has suffered a gross inequity because of what happened there, but not generally?
I still think that in order to compare the impact of financial matters upon a specific aspect of a company, you have to know what the company's overall financial condition is. And our evidence of financial condition in this case was done directly in response to SWEPCO's introducing, as I've said, reams and reams of testimony about our financial condition. And of course, as the court well knows, when we objected on the ground that it wasn't relevant, that was overruled. And as the court knows, we have the right, essentially, to fight fire with fire. If the court is going to allow in this evidence, then we have the right to rebut it in this particular case. But I do not understand how you can assess one aspect of the pie in terms of economic consequences if you don't know what the entire pie is.
But in any event, you say the gross inequity has gone out of the case, issue has gone out of the case, but that depends on the evidentiary argument that's before us.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. If you were to sustain either of their two evidentiary issues, the case would be reversed and remanded for
what trial. What is the What do you think the remedy is on the gross inequity provision?
The remedy for a gross inequity would seem to me to depend upon the way in which the case came to the court. If the case came to the court after the parties were in negotiation and there was a claim that one party was not negotiating in good faith, as a trial judge, I might look at that and say, I will accept jurisdiction of this case, I will abate it, I will appoint a master, and I will require you to comply with the conditions of the contract. I will then receive to negotiate a rate to eliminate the gross inequity. I'll then receive the report of the master and determine whether or not the parties are in good faith. If the parties are not in good faith, then I'll let a jury decide. It could come to the court in other ways.
But your position is that the court could hold the parties to the agreement and by one mechanism or another determine the rate.
Yes, but I do think in order to be true to the contract, you would have to remand the parties to some sort of process where they could negotiate in good faith. I do not think you can come directly to court to do that.
And if they don't agree, what's the remedy?
Yeah, and I think if they don't agree, that the remedy would be, as we say, as a trial judge, I would say the parties are not in good faith. There is a good faith obligation to mutually negotiate in good faith and agree. And if you don't, then, but only in that event, will we allow the jury to consider the question.
What question? What would the instructions to the jury
be? The question would be just exactly as the clause is written. Did one party or the other, depending on who's making the claim, suffer a gross inequity as a result of unusual economic conditions? Answer yes. Then specify either the rate or the amount of damages that it would take to remedy that inequity.
Was there negotiation over a period of years?
There was, as a matter of fact, Your Honor. In 1989, which was really what precipitated this lawsuit, and in fact the parties thought they had agreed. The jury found that there was not mutual agreement over that, and Burlington has accepted that finding and will not challenge it. But I think we are at the point where I need to get to what really is the crux of the argument by opposing counsel. When I took this case, I guess to some extent I was prescient, because I said they haven't done it now, but they are going to argue that the unjust enrichment claim is a contract submission. And that's the reason that I have gone through and tried to explain the way this contract is set up, because what actually happened in this case was the unjust enrichment claim was submitted because of SWEPCO's fear that these contracts were unenforceable. That is a perfect avenue for the doctrine of unjust enrichment. When benefits have been obtained and sums have been paid, but there is no contract remedy, unjust enrichment can step in through equity. And that is precisely why this unjust enrichment claim was submitted. They moved for judgment on the ground that their claim was inequitable. I know opposing counsel has not had time to study this record, but you need to look at their motion for judgment. They asked for prejudgment interest under equitable doctrines because their claim was that the issues upon which they took judgment were equitable in nature. I don't think this court is going to have much difficulty understanding, because it is held in Crest Construction, it is held in Truly versus Austin, it is held in the Woodward case and many other cases, that if a contract covers and fully adjusts the rights of the parties, you do not have a claim under restitutionary principles based on unjust enrichment.
What about the exception? If you can show duress, fraud, or undue advantage, do you agree that exception exists?
I don't agree, Your Honor, that happens if a contract still covers the party's rights. I mean, if you're talking about fraud and the inducement of the contract, bring a fraud out. If you're talking about undue advantage or duress in the performance of a contract, that's breach of contract. But the law appears to me in this court's decision to separate very, very well causes of action which are covered by a contract and causes of action which are based upon unjust enrichment. So,
Well, but aren't there some cases that say even if there is a contract, if you can show one of those three things, you can still get unjust enrichment?
There are no cases in my judgment that say if there is an valid, ongoing, and enforceable contract that can adjust the rights of the parties, that you can get that. There are many instances where a contract fails in some way or another when the unjust enrichment remedy is appropriate. I agree to sell you a bull.
Well,
you pay me $5,000 in advance. The bull is struck by lightning. There's no contract. The contract has failed, but you have a restitutionary principle, a restitutionary claim based on unjust enrichment.
Well, the two questions and the definition in this case appear to support your contention that it's equitable rather than on the contract, because there's no reference to the contract.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, and let me try to take that a little bit deeper, because this is very fundamental. Questions 7 and 9 talk about something that should have been charged, and you heard opposing counsel, very able argument, say that that was, quote, under the contract. And this is why I've gone to such pains to try to explain what the proper charges are under the contract. Burlington never charged anything that wasn't appropriate, and they have admitted that. So in order to have an overcharge, you have to have a contract standard and a charge that is greater than that. The only charges we ever made by admission were proper. So in this particular question, you're not comparing a contract rate with an improper charge. It has to just be something known as, well, jury, just look at this and let's all feel good about it.
Well, their argument is that the contract rate was something other than the escalation clause.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
If
and this
right
is why, let me tell you, this is where, this is it.
Not, but if they were right about that, simply on legal theory, then there had been an overpayment, they would have a cause of action for overpayment under a contract.
Oh, certainly.
Based on unjust enrichment.
Not based on unjust enrichment, based on the contract.
But it's an overpayment, so it's the money had and received cause of action.
No, not if there is an ongoing contract which adjusts the rights of the parties. This contract lives today. The parties perform it every day. And if there are overcharges or undercharges, the remedy is contract. If the contract fails, on the basis of some complete failure, I think Carbon calls it a total breach, then there may well be a remedy in unjust enrichment based on restitutionary principles. But the whole basis for unjust enrichment is the implication of a duty to pay. And the rhetorical question then that we have asked is, why do you imply a duty to pay when the parties can be fully recompensed by reference to the contract if it means what they say? Their problem is they have to take this first sentence of the gross inequity clause that just says the formulas will adjust the rate and say that's a fourth rate setting mechanism. A fourth one. You can't see it, but we know it's there.
But
that's why their contract law.
But isn't the recovery for a contractual overcharge what Professor Laycock calls restitution on the contract? What's wrong with that?
First of all,
it doesn't import an equitable component.
Well, what's wrong with that? Professor Laycock, in the middle of his brief, says that in order for the unjust enrichment remedy to be what he calls restitution, quote, on the contract, it has to be based on mistake or duress. And please find that part of his brief, because he pulls the card out from under their entire, by the way, Professor Laycock was hired by Swetco to write that brief. But
well, there's got to be some reason why you pay too much.
No.
Pay too much because you thought you owed too much. Too much for some other reason.
No. There is no too much here.
But if there were, I'm assuming that restitution on the contract simply says, I paid too much because I didn't realize what I was doing, and you should give me
money.
And
what I take restitution on the contract to mean is breach of contract. And that's just another way of saying breach of contract.
Before you sit down, would you address why you do not believe there's reversible error in excluding the deposition of the old Burlington Northern official regarding the meaning of the contract?
You want me to address the sanctions as well as the merits of the contention?
Well, I just want you to anticipate what's going to happen in the next 8 minutes and give your answer to
that. Well, it suffers from two problems. First of all, that is that we asked, I think, 5 times for any statement that they had from the witness Sandgren that they were going to introduce at trial. And they, first of all, told us they didn't have any such thing. And then when they finally discovered Sandgren's deposition in the files of their own lawyers, they immediately knew it was relevant to this case. And they notified us that they had it, but they said, I'm not going to give it to you. And in hearings before the court, they testified that, well, we'll give it to you promptly or it will be forthcoming. There's testimony in the record that we did not have it, which the trial judge believed. And the trial judge found in this case that this statement was withheld deliberately. And I think you can read into that finding that it was done as tactical gamesmanship.
Who was Sandrin?
He's a former Burlington Northern employee who testified in 1979 okay. about the impact of...
he was a Burlington employee.
That's correct. Right. He was. I think that the test here is abuse of discretion. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in saying that there was discovery abuse by withholding this statement until the day...
If there had been no abuse and no timeliness question. Would this have been...
Well, they discovered it more than 30 days before trial.
But setting all that aside and going to the merits, was it relevant? Should it have been produced but for these...
Right. Well, there's no question that it should have been produced because...
I mean, should it have been admitted in evidence but for...
should not have been admitted. Yes. Well, I rank this to kind of like an out-of-court experiment. Mr. Sandgren, 28 lines of testimony, was given in 1979 about the gross, so-called gross inequity under a contract that is not introduced in evidence and expresses only his opinion as to whether the economic circumstances that were apparent in that particular situation constituted a gross inequity under that particular contract. But like an out-of-court experiment, if you're going to introduce the experiment, you've got to show and say that it's relevant to these issues. I don't know how you can say that Sandgren's opinion about another contract whose provisions we don't know anything about and which is not anywhere to be found in the record, based upon economic issues and economic facts that are also not in the record, is in any way, shape, or form relevant to whether or not there was a gross inequity under a different contract with a different shipper with different provisions under different economic conditions. In addition to that, Sandgren's 28 lines of testimony is very cumulative. They loaded up the record in this case with all kinds of statements by Burlington Northern officials that they believed gross inequity occurred in this situation, they believed gross inequity occurred in that situation. So if they wanted to tar and feather Burlington Northern with opinions about when and under what circumstances gross inequities occur, they did that in spades, and this court would have to say, as I understand its most recent writings on this, that the whole case turned upon Mr. Sandgren's testimony in 1979 under a different contract.
But one question, your argument or your answer to the question seemed to indicate your primary concern was not relevant. But the trial court's order was based on a sanction for discovery abuse for not.
Well, I think,
So is relevance a proper inquiry on the issue that they raised on
this case. It is under this court's decision in National Union versus McKinney, where they found that the trial court was wrong in imposing sanctions, but that the admission of the testimony would not have been harmful. I mean, was harmless in any event. So yes, I think it is always an inquiry.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may I inquire how much time I have?
I believe you reserved 8 minutes, and you went over that because of our questions. So you still have 8 minutes.
Thank you very much. Let me begin by referring, I think the questions that Justice Baker, Justice Owens, and Justice Abbott have asked in the area of equitable remedies are precisely on point. I think Professor Laycock's amicus brief lays out very well both the Texas cases, which make it clear that where you have a breach of a contract, you can still have, in appropriate circumstances, an equitable remedy. Mr. Hatchell's response to Justice Baker was very carefully put. He said, no, he doesn't think it could exist when it's fully covered by the contract. And I concede that in the sense that if we could not show a breach of contract, if we could not show an overcharge, that a differential between the price that was actually charged and the price that should have been charged under the contract, as we asked the jury, then we are not entitled to recovery.
Well,
in
my question on that is, neither one of these issues state should have been charged under the contract.
Let me do one thing before I get that way. But just leave that up a minute. Let me address that, Your Honor. At tab 3, you will see how we plead our third cause of action, unjust enrichment, and you'll see that we plead expressly rates that should have been charged in compliance with the contract.
Well, I understand it, but that's not the question you asked the jury, is that right?
It is. It is the question I asked the jury. If you will look, Your Honor, I believe it's at, if you will look at tab 4, you will see that, and at the second page under tab 4, you will see that we say, did we receive an unjust enrichment by retaining all or part of the difference, if any, between the rate actually charged and the rate that should have been charged. Now, it does not have the words under the contract, but I think that was clearly understood. That was all the evidence the jury had. What we said should have been charged under the contract. And they cannot be heard complain about that.
Let me ask you this, though, but unjust enrichment was defined as the retention of money or property against the fundamental principles of justice or equity and good conscience. So if they're following that definition in the two questions, there's nothing about the contract either in the definition or the issue, even though they may have understood it. Aren't they limited to answering the question based on what they got?
Let me make the point first. No objection. They concede in their briefs even. They have no objection to the form of this question. They cannot object. Their only objection was we're not entitled to unjust enrichment theory submission because of the contract. So they can't now complain that...
Well, I can see why they'd say that if you're arguing unjust enrichment as a purely equitable relief outside the bounds of the contract. But your argument here is that it's restitution under the contract.
Absolutely it is, Your Honor. And if you look, what the unjust enrichment definition speaks to is the retention of the money or property, the retention of the sum, but the jury never gets to an overcharge unless they never get to whether we have a right to keep it or not, unless they decide under the contract that there was a differential between the rate that's actually charged and the rate that should have been charged. And I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that couldn't mean anything but under the contract.
But now, Mr. Hatchell argued that purportedly there's no dispute on the computation of the rates based on the formula.
You have to listen very carefully to Mr. Hatchell's argument, Your Honor. At least that's my experience in reading his briefs. What he says And in this he is correct, that mechanically, that formula was applied. They took the Western, for example, in 71, they took the Western Railroad's cost and they multiplied correctly. That much is true. He unfairly tries to argue from that we concede that that our appropriate charge, the price was charged. That's absolutely false. We wrote them, we complained to them, we demanded their cost figures. We have evidence that they were deliberately concealing their cost figures from us because they know, and there is no dispute about this, the utter failure to meet the agreed and explicit intent of the parties.
So then do I understand that the real basis of the whole dispute is, quote, the cost and what increments that Burlington either did or didn't put in there that made the cost so that if you have a wrong cost item, you can do whatever you want on the farm. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. That's not the dispute.
What is it then?
The dispute is this. You might argue at the margin, but there is no controversy that this vast gap between Burlington's cost and what they were charging us over. There is no dispute that there was an utter failure of that formula to perform and satisfy the intent of the contract, and that was to take the agreed base cost and escalate it up or down with cost increases in Burlington Northern. The Burlington Northern was sanctioned and not allowed to put in cost evidence because they refused, in the face of the trial court's order, to put in their studies which showed what their SWEPCO costs were. Now, I think that you can draw the legitimate inference that the reason they didn't is they probably were even getting a bigger spread than we knew. But that's not the issue. The court can take as given that those formulas failed and that there was a vast increase in charges over the increase in cost. That's not in controversy.
A moment ago, you were talking about an unjust enrichment, and you said that you're trying to distinguish something that Mr. Hatchell said. He said ordinarily or in some circumstances unjust enrichment is appropriate when you have a valid contract. Can you explain to us when it is and is not appropriate?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there are a number of circumstances. Interestingly enough, at page 8 of his original application, Mr. Hatchell gives you a number of exceptions when you can have unjust enrichment when there is an existing contract. You can even have quantum merit in circumstances of partial performance. Let me urge the court's attention to Professor Lakoff's plea. It is a black-letter misstatement of the law to say that the existence of express contracts excludes the application of principles of unjust enrichment of money had and received. We cite a number of cases illustrating that. Now, there are indeed, often the courts will require additional factors. Here, as Professor Lakoff explained in his brief, and as we've explained in our reply brief, duress clearly applies. Are taking undue advantage. We had absolutely no choice but to pay those invoices, Justice Baker, computed under a formula that we knew that had failed, because we had to keep the lights on. We had to take that
to find that as a matter of law?
I'm sorry?
Are you asking us to find duress as a matter of law?
Not at all. There was no objection below. We obtained a finding, and clearly there is a deemed finding of duress. We submitted an issue on unjust enrichment. We said principles, etc. They know the elements. They didn't object to it. They were smart not to tactically because I didn't want to.
Let me ask you a question. I know we're running out of time, but I'm not sure economists would agree that because you have one supplier, you're under duress to buy the supply. But that's a different issue. My question for you is, did the pricing arrangement for the purchase of this transportation fail? Or are you saying we're just having a dispute about how the pricing arrangement applies?
It failed.
So if it failed, then why aren't we here talking about equitable remedies for a contract that fails as opposed to urging, oh no, we're just seeking enforcement of the contract? I understood your argument to be, no, we're seeking enforcement of the contract by its terms, which has as its terms here. But isn't this really a case where you're arguing that the formula, that the pricing arrangement of the contract fails? and you are now here seeking an equitable solution to the pricing on this.
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor. We're seeking it on the contract, under the contract. We proved the failure of the formulas. We proved we were overcharged. And you remember that the fundamental...
Well, the only reason, that goes to my question, the only reason you're overcharged is not because we agreed to pay $5 and we ended up paying $7 by a bill that came in. We're only overcharged because the contract says if the $5 that's charged is unjust enrichment, you can go seek a different charge.
If I might respond, Your Honor, what the contract says, and there's no dispute about this, base rate, we agreed on a base rate. That's a fixed number under both contracts. Then we agreed that we would have a formula whose intent was to move it up or down with the railroad's cost on the SWEPCO route. That's what we agreed to pay. Base rate and protect them against cost increases, or if their cost went down, we got the benefit of it. That's clear. We picked the formula that failed, that did not satisfy, that did not meet the intent of the parties. And that's why we say we are paying more than it was ever intended that we pay. We are not paying base rate plus their cost increases. We are paying base rate plus a huge windfall profit to them that we never agreed to pay because that formula is totally out of whack. That formula gives weight to diesel fuel. They use one-fourth as much diesel fuel as it uses. It gives weight to how much you pay employees. Instead of six people on the train, they have two. The formula doesn't work. They know that. And they don't even deny that they're getting all these huge amounts above their cost increase. So we flatly say, under the contract, Judge, we are paying more than we ever agreed to pay and in violation of the clear intent of the parties.
The point is the pricing in this agreement failed, and we now have to look elsewhere to come up with a pricing arrangement.
That's right. I agree with that, Your Honor, but that's no different than a contract where you say we'll pay a just and reasonable price, or we'll pay market value, or we'll pay cost plus. And it's very easy, you know. There are standard railroad rates for capturing costs that they compute every year. They can do this. They could tell us in a minute what those costs were and what it would be if the formula had worked properly.
What if their costs were much higher than the industry average? Wouldn't you have a basis for complaint? Because your formula was to take an industry average, and if Burlington Northern's costs were way out of line, I don't think you'd be here.
No, we wouldn't, but your Honor brings up an interesting point. And if they were there repeatedly before 1980 when the Staggers Act was passed and deregulated. They came in repeatedly and said, we want more money because our costs are higher than the industry's cost. And this formula doesn't give us enough money. They came in, I believe, four times.
Here's what happened.
They got more money. They have a lot of leverage. You know, first, let me say, we are under duress. We've got to take that code. They would go and threaten to file unilateral tariffs with the ICC, et cetera, but we would negotiate. We had to keep the code coming. Now what happened, you know, and that's just why Mr. Sandman's testimony is so important. High-level vice president of Burlington, involved in these repeated efforts to get more money under gross inequity clauses, and what he said that the jury never got to hear is, this is the way we do it. This is the way we administer these clauses. He said if there's a $30,000 increase, that Burlington is entitled to more money under the gross inequity clause. That's the way they played it until they got to Texas. Then they kept that from the jury.
What about the argument that it's cumulative, that testimony would have been cumulative?
It's not cumulative, Your Honor. There were references by our expert to efforts by the Burlington to use the gross inequity clause to get money. Burlington executives, knowing that they were insulated from Mr. Sandwich's testimony, refused to make any admissions of that type about their administration and their understanding of the application.
Were there documents that showed how they had used it?
No.
Mr. Richman?
Yes, sir.
I think I understood Mr. Hatton to argue that this contract that you said now had failed, that he had bragged about this contract before the regulatory agency. If I remember his argument correctly.
Well,
would you briefly respond to that?
First, let me say, Your Honor, I don't know the facts. It wouldn't surprise me when they made the contract, they'd have to come in and say, this is a reasonable approved contract. I mean, you know, at the time, people thought we were going to run out of natural gas and that Wyoming coal was going to be our savior and people were building nuclear plants. But the world has changed a great deal. Railroads have been deregulated. They're like airlines. All of a sudden, they have external reasons to lower their cost, and they're lowering them, and they're making these huge profits. That's all well and good, but we guaranteed them a profit. And part of the reward for our guarantee was we got the benefit if their cost went down. And that's what they have refused to give us. And you listen again carefully to Mr. Hatcher. He says we have no remedy. We depend on the kindness of the railroads. If they agree to renegotiate it, and you can imagine when that will happen.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.